just adding that in.
Well, you want
to... We're gonna change things a little bit. Gary has a had to modify some files, which, knowing Gary for the last 25 years, is not at all unusual. So what I'd like to do right now is do some question and answers for Roanne and Patrick, if we could. And since Man Lee is not manning the mics because she doesn't know about this, there she is, I might ask you to come down to the mics and ask your questions of Roanne and Patrick right now for a few minutes. We're running a little bit behind, but that's okay. And so I'd like to open it up for questions for the first two speakers for this second half.
I have a question for Roanne. Is there evidence that breast cancer incidence for males is increasing relative to the obesity rate the same way as it is for women?
The answer is no. But the problem is the incidence of male breast cancer is so low that we probably wouldn't detect that, but we are not seeing it in the same way. The outcomes for male breast cancer are also not changing or seemingly related to weight gain, weight loss, or that kind of thing.
Thank you.
Oh, it's for Patrick. Is there a difference in the mortality once they've been treated for complications of diabetes?
I'm sorry, is there a decrease in the long-term mortality in patients? So one of the things about this area is that, first of all, the level of information that we have is relatively immature. So we don't know, for instance, what the long-term impacts are on the secondary aspects of diabetes, whether their vascular disease changes, whether their peripheral neuropathies improve. We do know from the literature with respect to chronic renal failure that many of these patients, as they lose weight, their renal function will improve, and many of them don't end up on, who start off thinking they're on a transplant list, end up not being on a transplant list. So there's a lot of indirect evidence that suggests that a lot of the secondary medical problems are related will get better. The Swedish obesity study has been the best study to look at long-term mortality issues, and has across the board been able to show that, in general, mortality rates are less for people who have had weight loss surgery than the average weight population, than the match cohort that they're followed against. So, but that's been the best data that's been looking at long-term data, and not specifically addressing diabetes.
I have a question for Ryan. Did your group include BRCA patients? Did you separate out the BRCA patients, or was that all patients?
So again, the patients actively on these trials were those on systemic therapy. Brachytherapy, as you know, is a form of local regional radiotherapy. So
no, sorry, BRCA patients.
Oh, BRCA. No, we did not select nor restrict, so it was not part of the eligibility criteria. I'm curious why you would be asking, what's your rationale? BRCA is just looking to see if they are carry the gene, which predicts for a higher risk of breast cancer and or ovarian cancer.
Right, but so you were looking at recurrence rates as well, weren't you?
Okay, so our studies were not looking at recurrence rates. The studies, so some of the literature I quote you, where we associate less physical activity, weight gain, or obesity with recurrence. These are multiple studies. I mean, there's now hundreds in the literature. These are large epidemiological studies. They will include patients that are BRCA positive, but the proportion of patients that are BRCA positive in your general population is extremely low, so it would not influence that comment.
Go ahead, Todd. We've got one more way up here for the mic, if we can get the mic over to up top left.
Sure. Hi, Roland. Great talk, guys. I have a question regarding the breast cancer patients. I've learned to fly fish over the last few years, and there's a program called Casting for Recovery, helping women regain motion in their shoulders. As an orthopedic surgeon, I see a fair number of patients who've had breast cancer surgery with shoulder problems. I know you worked on different kinds of exercise, but I'm just curious what your thoughts are on those kind of programs.
So any program that gets that woman moving, in particular, as you suggested, improves and addresses shoulder range of motion, is to that woman's benefit. There was huge, I'm just going to take your question and sort of parallel it a little bit. There were huge concerns, as you know, about lymphedema, and the comments were, you can't do anything, you're not supposed to use that arm because of these inherent risks. Katie Schmidt did a beautiful study a couple of years ago, was published in the New England Journal, and she actually took women who had established lymphedema and put them on a weight program. I actually had it in the talk and had to take it out for time constraints. Bottom line is, the women who exercised and lifted weights, albeit it was a supervised program, they had less lymphedema, less symptoms. In other words, suggesting if you train and rehabilitate somebody properly, your outcome is going to be better. So to your point, yes. In other words, whether you want to do it as a formal exercise program or just through general exercise, get them going, we take anything. There's no contraindications.
So would you have them fly fishing, Todd?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, this question is for Patrick. What are the relative costs of the various treatment modalities for diabetes, medical, surgical, and does that impact the patient selection over the long term from a social economic point of view?
You know, that's a good question, and the medical economics of this are a little bit complicated because there are a lot of newer interventions with respect to medical therapy that are increasingly expensive. So there's some data published that suggests that the break-even point in a patient who has surgery with respect to medical costs is about 2.5 years after the surgery, and that after you reach that point, there's actually a cost savings over time in terms of diabetes management. So that's an important consideration.
So this is a question for Patrick. As a public health physician, you know, talking about bariatric surgery for obesity is kind of like, but we have to be a little bit realistic. It took 40 years to deal with tobacco, and you know, nobody has to smoke, but everybody has to eat. So obviously the public health interventions to deal with the obesity epidemic are going to take at least twice that long, probably. So we're looking at, you know, 60 or 70 years of uncontrolled obesity in the population. So given that the States is kind of the center of enterprise and innovation, at least in the term in some areas, shouldn't we be training hundreds and hundreds of technicians to be able to do this surgery in every place in North America to meet the demand? Not to say that surgeons aren't wonderful, but we're never going to be able to afford or train enough, you know,
you know, it's
20-year
it's,
surgeons.
It's really an interesting question. So there was an article in Nova Scotian Rag about a year and a half ago that I was asked to comment on. There was a patient who ostensibly needed bariatric surgery. She was put on the wait list. The wait list was 3,000 patients long. They have one bariatric surgeon in Nova Scotia who does a limited number of cases per year. And so, you know, I remember when I did my residency there, we had a cardiac service. We did 5 cardiac cases a day in each room, 5 rooms. They had the largest cardiac surgery program in Canada in terms of patient output, and one of the largest in North America, and it's because they recognized in Nova Scotia everybody had coronary artery disease. Now, obviously, their volumes are down because everyone gets stents now, but the idea that this is the same type of public health issue as cardiac disease was back then, I don't think has sort of hasn't gotten the same legs conceptually, despite the fact that the reality is we're being overridden by this problem. People talk about this being in a very expensive modality. In truth, in the United States, they spend $88 billion a year on medical management of obesity. They spend $4 billion a year on the surgical management of obesity. If you look at what works and what doesn't work, surgery works and medical management generally doesn't. So it's really about where you shift your resources, what you make your priorities about. The reality that unfortunately, obesity is sort of the last acceptable, making comments, prejudice against obesity is sort of the last acceptable prejudice that exists in North America. And for those reasons, it's a complex issue. So.
Okay, we have time for one or two at the most.
left. Rob, go ahead.
Yeah, I have a question for Roanne. I see a fair number of people who have what they describe as chemo brain, you know, cognitive changes after chemotherapy. When you looked at your data, did you look at any cognitive parameters of the different exercise groups? And if not, do you have a few quick words about how does one approach and possibly improve and treat chemo brain?
Yeah, so we did not look at that in our studies. So chemo brain is not a well-defined entity at all. We believe it truly exists, but what exists, I don't know. What we think we see clinically post-chemotherapy of multiple sorts is the woman's, and it's typically the woman who has received treatment for breast cancer, her inability to multitask and function at the level she previously did. This is anecdotal reporting that it's the most highly engaged, skilled, intellectually functioning woman that complain the most, suggesting that there's probably something there, and if you're challenging your brain, that's probably the woman that feels it. Right now, the literature is not developed. We have very poor tools to even objectively measure this. We use tools that are more used in brain injury to evaluate these women just because we don't have good tools. So there's been a real shift, and certainly at our center, Lise Paquette has started to look at this, and the first task is going to be to validate. She's come up with a tool, and she's looking to validate that tool so we can have a good baseline function pre-post. There's also been some MRI studies looking to see if there's different blood flow pre-post by Barbara Collins. That's not borne out. So what we see clinically and reproducibly is a woman's complaint about not being able to do as much, and it really speaks to multitasking, and many of the solutions are about problem solving. In other words, always park your car in the same place, always put your keys in the same place, versus understanding the pathophysiology of it, unfortunately.
Do we have one more? Eugene, go ahead.
Hey. As, since you mentioned kidney disease, and I'm the only nephrologist in our class, I mean, you're...
There's one sitting beside you there, the cute guy with the blue. That's you, Stephen.
Well, anyway, it's very true. I mean, a lot of the changes, and we have lots of patients we refer now for bariatric surgery with renal disease and end-stage renal disease. The wait time for transplants is averaging up to 6 years. And the problem is you can't get listed for transplant until your EGFR is under 20 cc's per minute. And so the criteria now for transplant is getting stricter and stricter. The BMI at Duke for transplant is 40. And you don't know how many patients I've had knocked off lists because of that BMI. And so we're referring more and more for bariatric surgery just to get them on a transplant list. It does, but you're also right, it does slow down progression of disease once they get it, because their blood pressure is so much easier to control, they get off all their meds. But there are also primary renal diseases that are associated with obesity. You know, they get FSGS and glomerulomegaly. And right now, the basic treatment for FSGS is what? Give them steroids, and they gain 50 more pounds. So these patients, you know, I'm referring them for treatment for their primary kidney disease by bariatric surgery, because weight loss is the only thing we know that actually will reverse this, often this process. So I think there's more applications than just the diabetes, but the diabetes is the number one, you know, reason people are on dialysis and kidney disease now in the States.
Well, you know, the truth is I could talk all day long about how we can make everything better. And the slide I didn't show at the end was basically, the checklist of all the different medical problems that are specifically attributed to obesity and how all of them get better when they have patients have weight loss surgery that's successful. And most importantly, not just being successful on the front end, but, you know, from a behavioral point of view, making it possible for them to maintain their weight loss over time. And the Achilles heel in our business has been that there's this perception that that many patients will regain weight over time. And I think that in the early days of bariatric surgery, there was not nearly enough attention paid to the behavioral aspects of weight loss subsequent to having the operation. The operation really is a tool to get from people from A to B. We think that it has a large impact on people having reset their set points in terms of what their weight's going to be once they achieve their nadir weight. But I think that, we could have the same conversation about hypertension, the same conversation about renal disease, sleep apnea, you name it, and it's just one of those things.
All right, thank you very much. Yep. Quickly.
So first of all these procedures now perform laparoscopically, okay? And there's a movement towards single port procedures for many of these procedures, especially in lower weight patients. As far as endoscopic procedures that are being done, at this point in time, there are no good endoscopic therapies that are available. There was a, I forget the name of the trial that was just closed down where they did an endoscopic suturing, used an endoscopic suturing device to try and narrow the channel of the stomach with a small outlet at the bottom, and they stopped the study because the suture lines were breaking down and the weight loss was insignificant. Conceptually, it sounds great to do endoscopic procedures. I think that probably what we're looking at down the road, especially with the sleeve gastrectomy operation, because I think it's the best operation as a primary procedure, is we're going to be looking at natural orifice techniques. But I think we're going to see that before we see endoscopic treatment.
Thank you.